You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of AIDS 2008, the 17th International AIDS Conference. The conference took place in Mexico City from August 3rd through August 8th, 2008.
My name is David Malbranch. I'm an assistant professor with Emory University Division of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. I work predominantly at Grady Hospital doing clinical work with HIV as well as research, particularly with black communities and black MSM.
Okay, so what did you think was the most interesting part of the conference?
It wasn't necessarily all the clinical stuff. But I think for me, the timing of the International AIDS Conference this year was particularly appropriate given the president's reauthorization and expansion of the PEPFAR program, as well as the recent AIDS statistics that came out that showed that there was an incidence in 2006 of 56,300. And then on top of that, you look at the Black AIDS Institute, which put out a report called Left Behind, which basically talked about how the epidemic in Black America is similar to those in a lot of these countries that are being supported by PEPFAR, and actually putting out a document that supports or leans us towards getting a national PEPFAR in the United States.
Uh-huh. What do you think of all the MSM stuff? Was this so unique at the international conference?
Yeah, I didn't see, I saw some MSM stuff, but I didn't really see a lot of stuff that was noteworthy to me. I saw some stuff from other countries that basically was reiterating a lot of things we already know. There's a lot of homophobia, there is a lot of bisexual behavior, and a lot of it has to do with culturalization, masculine socialization, things like that. But I didn't see a lot of stuff relating that to risk. So again, what I see a lot of times with these presentations about bisexuality and about MSM is we always talk about, well, they could pose a potential risk, but then when you look at the data, you know, there's a difference between whether you are bisexual and whether you use condoms. And I think sorting through that and fine-tuning that discussion needs to be done, because a lot of people just lump the two together. So they say, well, they're bisexuals and they're having sex with both men and women, so they're probably the bridge from MSM to heterosexuals. Instead of saying, well, they could be the bridge from heterosexuals to homosexuals as well if there's a large, you know, prevalence of HIV among heterosexual women. And I don't see that discussion taking place too much, nor do I see the discussion of condom use really happening that often. It's usually just by default, since you're bisexual, you're probably running around willy-nilly, you know, not using condoms and just careless about who your sexual partners are.
What did you think of the CDC releasing their statistics in time for the conference? I mean, and the numbers.
I mean, I thought it was timely. I mean, particularly at the International AIDS Conference. I think what it did for me, and probably for a lot of other people, it really brings home, you know, the epidemic in the United States. We can congratulate, you know, President Bush and Congress for doing such a wonderful job with PEPFAR and, you know, promoting these treatment and prevention initiatives internationally to countries that need it, as far as getting the infrastructure together. But I think in the setting of that congratulatory foundation, we realize that it's exposed us for that we don't have this kind of foundation. We don't have this kind of infrastructure. We don't have this kind of framework within the United States. And given the fact that there was incidence estimates that were around 40,000 that were previous, and now they're saying, well, it's about 20% higher. It's 56,300. That's a huge jump, and that's a huge miscalculation, even though probably the methods that they were estimating those numbers were a little bit more archaic from previous years. But I think it highlights or exposes the U.S., like, okay, well, are you going to put out burning bushes throughout the world? Or are you going to take care of your fire at home? And I think that's one of the things we have to address coming home from this conference. So I think the CDC releasing those statistics and that JAMA issue, special issue with HIV/AIDS, was particularly timing in the context of the International AIDS Conference.
Uh-huh. And a few weeks ago, I think there was a morbidity and mortality report, and they talked about who the population where the most infection seemed to be occurring. Mm-hmm. And I think that was young black men.
Yeah, young black MSM particularly. I mean, but we've known this for years. It's been probably close to a decade that we've been talking about black MSM, young black MSM, middle-aged black MSM, so on and so forth. I'd say up from the ages of 13, probably through 44, you could say, are getting hit the hardest. And there seems to be a focus on this, you know, the heterosexual epidemic, whereas still we're looking at two-thirds of the epidemic in the United States. These incidence estimates were among men who have sex with men. And maybe a quarter of them were among, you know, heterosexual women. And so it really, again, exposes us for kind of what we need to look at here. And I think, you know, one of the arguments that starts to come out of it, one of the discussions that needs to come out of it, is this whole issue of the HIV guilty and the HIV innocent. And we used to talk about that back in the day. And I think we need to revisit that conversation, because at this point, what's happening is that you see money being flooded from federal institutions into academic institutions, faith-based organizations, community-based organizations, so that people can travel overseas, particularly to Africa, to do HIV prevention work and treatment work. And meanwhile, these same people that are traveling to Africa will basically step over the homeless person living with AIDS right outside their organization's door so they can get in their limo and drive to the airport so they can fly to Africa, which is a really strange dynamic to me. So, you know, to me, when I'm looking at all this, and the only conclusion I can come to is that at the end of the day, when you look at the estimates in Africa, and in several of the countries in Africa that they've done surveillance about what the specific risk behavior is, it's usually heterosexual transmission, and it may be predominantly more so women than men. And so the only explanation I can come up with is that at this point, you know, MSM and bisexuals and IV drug users are still being pathologized, and even heterosexuals are being pathologized here as if they're dirty, as if they're wrong, and no one wants to help folks here, but yet we'll travel thousands of miles overseas to help out people in other countries and then pat ourselves on the back while the epidemic is brewing here and continually getting worse, which is very, very strange and kind of shows us this whole mix of morality, religion, judgment, discrimination, and stigma that we have in this country that we're just afraid to talk about.
Uh-huh. And your population of patients you treat, could you tell me a little bit about them?
Yeah, the population, I work at the Pont Center in Atlanta, Georgia, which is a clinic that specifically deals with folks who have a clinical diagnosis of AIDS, either by an AIDS-defining illness or a T-cell count less than 200. And what happens there, the population is predominantly African-American, predominantly uninsured. And for my clinic, I see predominantly males. And I have white males, Hispanic males, males of Asian descent, a whole, you know, mix of ethnicities. But I'd say about 85 to 90% are men of African descent, whether from Native Africa, from the Caribbean, or African-American. And a large proportion of them are MSM. Some are heterosexual, some were bisexual, some are IV drug users. But the vast majority reflects the epidemic in the nation, which is basically that MSM are being predominantly impacted.
And are you finding that they're getting enough support and that there's enough services to serve them, whether prevention or treatment?
Yeah, I think it's difficult and there are a lot of hoops to go through. I mean, I think obviously our clinic is, we're sponsored by Ryan White, and then, you know, at Grady Hospital, we also will accept private insurance. So I have some patients who are on private insurance, but then they have to go out to get their labs drawn someplace else instead of at our building because they contract with different lab services. So that makes things difficult. But I think the main thing is that I've noticed with patients over the years, over the past 7 years that I've worked there, is that patients have a particularly difficult time jumping through the hoops to get on treatment. Once they get on treatment, the services are there. They can kind of coast, but there are so many hoops to jump through, so much paperwork to fill out, so many people to see, so much traveling back and forth to do. And you're talking about a population who, you know, may not have a car, dealing with substance abuse, mental health illness, all kinds of other issues, stigma and discrimination from being homosexual, and you're asking them to do all these things just to get their medications. A lot of people get turned off and turn away, but the ones who stick to it, if they have, you know, good support staff from the social workers, the providers, the staff at our clinic, which is very supportive, once they get over that hurdle and they get plugged in, they usually do fine. So it's just a matter of getting over that hurdle to getting it if you're uninsured, and then kind of getting on with your life after that.
Uh-huh. But services could, I mean, is there transportation vouchers? And other,
yeah, I mean, yeah, we do all that. We'll give them, you know, services for the trains or the bus and tokens or Breeze cards we have for the MARTA system in Atlanta. So we do all these things in Atlanta, Georgia, but it's a matter of kind of giving it together because you have to prove that you're at a certain level below the poverty line and you're not making enough money in order to qualify for these services. So in some respects, it's kind of a catch-22 because after you have somebody who's diagnosed with AIDS and their main objective is to basically, can I live the next few months? Am I going to live the next few months? Am I going to live to see the next year? Once you get them over that hump and you say, well, okay, now you you can live your life. What did you want to do before? Did you want to go to school? Did you want to work this job? What did you want to do with your life before HIV hit you? Then all of a sudden they reach this crossroads where it's like, well, okay, if I go to school and if I get a good job, then I'm going to be making too much money to qualify for the services that I had before. And then I'm going to have to work harder. It's going to make it more difficult. I'm going to have to pay more out of pocket for my medications, so on and so forth. So in some ways, it's almost an incentive for people not to work, not to pursue their jobs, and just to kind of stay uninsured and not making enough money. And so I think that a lot of times it gets a little bit difficult for patients to kind of grapple with that once they want to get going. But I've seen a lot of success stories with it. So, you know, I know it can be done, but it's a very difficult thing to have to choose in your life. You know, do I pursue my dreams and become successful like I wanted to and risk losing my insurance temporarily or losing my benefits temporarily and risk getting off meds, even though now my viral load is undetectable and my T cells are in the 500 range, whereas they were 10 before. Right. So it's very, very difficult to negotiate that. And there's no how-to book, there's no Dr. Spock book to kind of explain that to you. But there needs to be more information out there. And if you don't have kind of a supportive clinic, supportive family, supportive community, supportive providers, it's going to be a lot more difficult. It's like you almost have to be out there on your own.
Uh-huh. And I was wondering, would you, I know you're not staying for the late breaker, but do you know a little bit about some of them? Could you talk about the Abacavir data a little bit?
Not in great detail. I went to a review of some of the clinical data previously, and back in January of this year, Epsicom was actually listed as one of the preferred, you know, initial regimens for naive patients to start, along with Truvada plus Sustivo or PI. And what happened was that some studies started to come out after that that showed that, you know, if your viral load was over 100,000, you may have worse outcomes with Epsicom as opposed to Truvada. And then also there was a large cohort, multi-country, multi-city, that showed an increased risk of MIs among people who were on Epsicom as opposed to Truvada. And I think that's interesting data. And I think in combination with the stuff we were talking about yesterday, which was looking at, you know, the hypersensitivity reaction to Abacavir and the HLA B5701 test that we usually get, and if people are positive, it's more predictive of whether they'll have that hypersensitivity reaction. And I think what the problem is that when you look at a lot of these studies, you know, the question you have to ask yourself as a provider is, does it apply to my individual patients? And so, you know, for me, working at a predominantly African American clinic where you have a high prevalence, co-prevalence of other chronic diseases like hypertension, renal insufficiency, diabetes, Truvada may not always be the best option because of tenofovir's tendency to irritate the kidneys sometimes. So a lot of times you really have to take this data and look at it and synthesize it and see what the population was that they were studying with, and then say, well, okay, each individual patient that comes up, let me see what's going on with them and see if they're actually a candidate for this. Because although all the data may say that Epsicom is not as good as Truvada for a certain particular patient, when you look at your individual patient, if they have chronic renal insufficiency and their viral load is less than 100,000 and their HLA B5701 is negative, I would put them on Epsicom instead of Truvada. So you have to take the data and then apply that to kind of each individual case.
Uh-huh. Are you presenting data today about renal insufficiency?
I'm not.
Oh, okay.
I am presenting data about, I do more behavioral research, so I don't do clinical trials. And I'm presenting some data we did with the Minority AIDS Research Initiative, which is a cooperative agreement with the CDC. And basically was a 3-year study looking at the issue of gender role conflict, racial identification as black among black MSM, and looking at sexual risk behavior along the road and seeing whether, you know, these men who were experiencing higher gender role conflict strain or if they were having a positive racial identity as being black, did that influence their condom use practices?
And did it?
It was a little bit complicated. We had a sample size of about 480. And what we found was that gender role conflict, like being more conflicted about being a man, about certain things like being successful, you know, not being emotional, those kind of things you get socialized to be as a man, didn't necessarily predict unprotected anal intercourse with this population with other men. But among the small subset, we had about maybe 75 men who reported having sex with both men and women in the past 6 months. Among that small subset that was bisexual, it did influence that. So what was interesting was that, you know, it may not be particularly relevant when it comes to your male sexual partners, but we need to actually do more work to find out exactly what's going on with the female sexual partners. And I think, you know, when I look at a lot of that research, a lot of the behavioral research with black MSM and black bisexual men, and even white bisexual men, Latinos, Asians, so on and so forth, what you realize is it has a lot to do with people are choosing condoms and behaviors based on, you know, individual characteristics, gender characteristics, and then also situational characteristics.
What do you mean by that?
Individual could be, do they trust the person? Is it a casual relationship versus a, you know, a long-term relationship? Are they married? Is it someone they've been with for 5 years? That may be more of a primary determinant or predictor of whether you use condoms or not than whether it is a male or a female. So if you really trust someone, if you're really in love, if you've been with somebody for 4 or 5 years, and we've seen this with the heterosexual data, the homosexual data, the bisexual data, people are more likely to forego condoms because you think, well, this is my boo. I've been with them for 5 years. So I know they aren't tipping out on me. Whereas with a casual partner, you'll say, well, I don't know where this person's been, so I need to strap up. And so what's interesting is that we still need to tease out and look at the complexity, because it's not as simple as somebody being straight identified or gay identified, whether they're, you know, man or woman. It has a lot more to do with, like, more general human characteristics and life situations and kind of how you feel about that individual that may be a determinant of whether you use condoms or not.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah,
so what's your next step? Are you doing another similar study?
I'm working on a study right now. I'm working on a revision for an R01 grant that I submitted. And we're actually trying to look at a cohort of black men in the state of Georgia and doing comparisons between, you know, those who are behaviorally heterosexual, bisexual, homosexual, as well as looking at rural versus urban areas and different age groupings. And we're looking particularly at issues of mental health. So qualitatively, what are the facilitators of good mental health? What are the barriers of good mental health? And does that have an impact on sexual risk behavior and testing practices? And looking at things like stress coping, we'll use measures like depression scales, perceived stress, those kind of things. It'll be interesting. I don't think anyone's really done a large cohort of black men just recruited. Are you over the age of 18? Do you identify as black or African American? And then let the behavioral categories from the demographic responses stratify them out into heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual. Up to now, we've been kind of focusing, well, why don't we do a study with homosexual men? Why don't we do a study with bisexuals? Why don't we do a study with heterosexuals? What we've been finding in a lot of our research is that regardless of who someone is having sex with or how they sexually identify, there are common cultural threads and experiences about being a black man in America that I think we need to closely examine. And until we examine those things, we'll be kind of running around looking at risk groups based on how you sexually identify or who you're, what the gender of your sexual partner is, and we still may be missing the boat about some of these general things, you know, situational things like poverty, mental health, stress, that regardless of, you know, how you sexually identify, you're going to be, you know, subject to some of those social stressors.
Right. My final question is, I don't know how many of these international AIDS conferences you've been to, but okay.
So, including this one.
So I was wondering, I mean, do you think that these make a difference? That these change anything, or are there just a lot of talk?
No, because I've never been the proponent that talking is doing nothing. You know, there are some people that will go to conferences and complain like, oh, we're just doing a lot of talking and no one's coming up with solutions. And I need to hear solutions with each session. You need to tell me what I need to do, you know, with my population. And I'm very clear that, you know, when we give sessions, when there's a workshop that I go to, I'm not looking at the presenter to give me the answers to my population. I'm looking to hear what they have to say. And then I'm going to take that and process it and go from there. I think people can get out of conferences what they want to. You can go to a conference, listen to some stuff, leave, and never do anything with the information at all, whether you're a clinician or a service provider or a person living with HIV. But if you go to the conference wanting to make connections, wanting to learn, and then bring some of that stuff, make connections and maybe incorporate some of the things that you see into your own community, or maybe it'll inspire you to do some work on your own, that's what I think you can get out of it. So I think the talk is always good, and I don't think we talk enough about these kind of things. And so I don't think they're a waste of time at all. It's only a waste of time if you decide it's going to be a waste of time and you don't decide to do anything with the information you're given.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
No problem.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on the 17th International AIDS Conference from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/AIDS2008.